Hello, and welcome to Beyond the Margins, Australian Editors in Conversation, created on the traditional lands of the Yuggera and Turrbal people in Meanjin, Brisbane. This series was first conceived in the hallways of University of Queensland Press by editors Jacqueline Blanchard, Felicity Dunning, and Margot Lloyd. It has been made possible with the generous assistance of the Institute of Professional Editors. In this episode, we speak to Sophie Cunningham about learning on the job as an editor at McPhee Gribble and making the move from editor to publisher. Sophie now works as a non-fiction writer, novelist, and teacher of creative writing. This interview was recorded in December 2023.
Thank you, Sophie, for joining us. So of all the editors we've interviewed, and some of them have had really enormous careers and very successful careers, you've had one of the most extraordinary careers in the sense that you started out as an editor in your first role in the publishing industry with McPhee Gribble, and then you sort of worked your way up to become a successful publisher, also at McPhee Gribble and then at Allen & Unwin for many years. And then you sort of took off these publishing hats and have become a sort of successful author in your own right with 9 books under your belt. You've done a lot of work around the industry. So you've helped establish the Stellar Award, the Stellar Prize, which is an award for Australian women and non-binary writers. So you've had this amazing career. Can you tell us, just to start off with, a little bit about those first editorial roles you had and what you enjoyed about it, what you found difficult about it?
Because this was in the years before there was training, before you did a course, if you're at all interested. And to be honest, I didn't even really understand that publishing was a thing in the way that, I don't know, you drink milk and you don't think about the cows or how the milk comes to be. I was like that with books. So I was a huge reader. I did an arts degree in literature and film, but it didn't occur to me that there was a job in any of this. And I think partly because my parents were teachers and I just assumed I'd become a teacher. I didn't really have a sense of what I wanted to do. And I then got a job at the Melbourne Times. This was in about 1985, where I was writing arts reviews and real estate. Hilary McPhee, who my father used to drink at the pub with her partner, then partner, Don Watson, and she read some of my reviews and asked me if I wanted to assess manuscripts, you know, the slush pile. So basically I started to go into McPhee Gribble and, you know, there were hundreds of them and it would help the more senior editors kind of make I'd recommend which books they should look at. So I wouldn't make decisions, but I'd say, I think these are the ones you should look at.
Okay. Well, so how many were they getting back then, do you think?
A lot.
Yeah.
Like a real lot. There were literally piles. Yeah. Like I would be sitting on the floor surrounded by piles, and I was probably at 21, I think. And then Robin and Nia, she worked at McPhee Gribble and then she became an editor at McPhee Gribble. And then after about 6 weeks, I think, she would obviously know the details better than me. I think she thought, I actually don't want to be an editor. So that junior job came up and I went for it and I got it. And then I was sort of at McPhee Gribble. And that was just I was doing helping with reprint new editions. But new editions are things like postcards from surfers or reprints, you know, imprint pages, all this kind of stuff. And then I, in blurbs, I actually had a bit of a talent for copywriting, so I would kind of start doing blurby stuff. And I was being overseen with a couple of more senior, Sue Hines was in there and also and Hilary McPhee was also kind of paying attention or kind of making sure that I was on track. And Hilary in particular really did put a lot of energy into making sure I was good at the job. I think she probably had a strong sense of, you reflect the company. So that just because she was really good at it, if the editors she was pretending to have meetings with people weren't good at what they did, well, that reflected badly on McPhee Gribble. And so I ended up, I think the first book I copy edited, as opposed to just proofing and general surrounding production work, was Cocaine Blues by Kerry Greenwood.
Wow.
And because that was a, you know, Kerry wasn't known, it was the first book, I think it was her first book altogether. And because it was a bit generic and playful, I think they thought, everyone thought it would be safe to let me loose on it. But I also did several short story collections. Say, Karen Goldsworthy's one really stays with me. Alan Close, quite a few short story collections. And Hillary would always go through the manuscripts that I'd copy edited and give me feedback or say, you can't say that, or you didn't pick up this. So I got really close.
Yeah.
Like an apprenticeship. It was more that kind of really labour intensive for her. Now, in retrospect, that period probably only went on for 9 months or a year. I ended up copy editing Bristol and Jessica's Poppy, for example. So some pretty significant books.
I guess it's kind of like the process of trust too, isn't it? It's like Hillary probably realised that, you know, once she'd sort of seen what you'd done and you'd learned a little, because that early stage of editorial, it is very hard. I think there's a real dilemma between when are you good to start? When are you sort of confident to go in and have a crack at it on your own? And there's only one opportunity. So having someone come back and actually look at your work is one of the best ways to learn. Yes.
And obviously, particularly with authors that she... books that were particularly that she'd done most of the work on, say Poppy, she obviously kept a very close eye on it. But basically, in this early period, apprenticeship period, did check all my work just to make sure that, you know, authors that weren't as always well known that they also would be treated, you know, well.
Yeah,
and so I started mainly on fiction, and Diana Gribble. Even I did actually work on a couple of the early Kaz Cooks and nonfiction. Oh, the first book I proofread, sorry, I'm all over the place now, was by Peter Kundal. It was Peter Kundal's first gardening book. And I just can't tell you how many typos I let through. Like, I still have the first edition. I had a 70s education, bit of a fiasco. But
well, I'm sure everyone has a story about that feeling of like, it's my fault.
And nonfiction was quite useful in that it taught me things about fact checking and the double checking spelling of language I'm not familiar with. And I work quite hard. You know, I wasn't born with. I have a flair for editing, but I didn't have a flair for being attentive to detail at all. That was not my normal instinct, and I had to really learn how to, you know, I learned how to proofread and that kind of visual training of using a ruler and all that kind of stuff. So I got a lot of craft training in quite an intense period. I mean, for me it felt like years, I mean, in a good way, in fact I realised I was only there for 2 years before we were acquired by Penguin, and things changed quite dramatically. And I did work with Diana on, say, Kaz Cook's books and Peter Kundal, I remember. So Diana was doing more of the non-fiction and Hillary was doing more of the fiction. So I kind of worked with both of them. And while Diana was very focused on the really detailed craft, the proofreading, the craft, the checking headings, the blues, the production.
And more the traditional kind of aspects, potentially.
So she gave me that, and Hillary was more the kind of, you know, I suppose we call creative, the kind of supporting the work and trying to make it as good as it can be. So they both had very different skills, but this was also part time of paste up.
Yes.
You know, so you literally had, and there was a, I worked on Dorothy Hewitt's biography, Wildcard, and there is somewhere in the first edition, you know, as a little girl, she goes skipping to the shop to buy lollies and then suddenly is in Perth being a student. But there's this, I can't remember the details, but there's this massive leap, and it was basically because the cut and paste had gone wrong. And there was kind of paragraphs from a later chapter were just whacked into the middle of a childhood chapter.
Oh, wow.
So, and no, we didn't notice, and it went to print.
Yes.
Like, no one noticed because I had, well, not just because I hadn't checked the breaks, but the thing of checking the breaks was something I was learning, and the proof, no one in the proofreader hadn't picked it up. And it's possible I was the proofreader, I can't even remember. And it also because Dorothy had a stream of consciousness style, the alarm bells didn't ring in the same way. And she called me. I mean, I called her, and she, I said, oh, this has happened. I was just feeling terribly distressed. She said, oh, no one will notice, love. I'm like, so she was the perfect author. And she was, A, she was right. We did fix it, but she didn't demand that we pulp it or whatever. Anyway, so the writers were also very good to me, I think is what I'm saying in a long-winded way.
That's good. I think learning by mistake is kind of how you do learn a lot in editorial as well. Like, it's sort of those, well, we say at work, you never make a mistake, you make a discovery, because it's just like you've just got to take something away from it and try and build your skill set as you go, because it is a very human sort of subjective job.
And also, to be honest, I've never not worked like that. No matter what I'm working on with my own writing, when I'm teaching writing, even though I did theory at uni and was very fascinated by theory, in my professional and personal life, I'm very much like, I have to figure this out by doing it. You know, if I'm cooking, I don't necessarily focus properly on the recipe. I do it to see how it works. And so that kind of, it's not exactly a physical job, but it is a craft, and that works very well with how my brain, fits well with how my brain works, I think.
Yeah. So from that editorial space, like, I think a lot of editors are interested in becoming publishers. There are a lot of editors who are just happy working and doing that book work and loving that book work. I'm probably one of those. The differences between editorial and sort of publishing, it sounds like you had a really nice relationship in with your publishers when you started as an editor. When you moved to Penguin, you became a publisher?
Yes, but it was a bit more complicated than that. The acquisition was traumatic. Diana went and started Text. I mean, it wasn't just wasn't Text exactly as we know Text today, but she and Eric Beecher started another company, and Hillary went with the books and was contracted to kind of, I think it was for 3 years, I can't remember, 2 or 3 years, to at least oversee the transition of the backlist to Penguin. And that, this is where I do need to be slightly delicate. That was a difficult, it was not a happy time for her professionally. She was very frustrated by working with Penguin. I, in my naivety, didn't kind of realise that, because I was having perfectly pleasant dealings with Penguin, but I didn't quite understand that just because they were being nice to me and others, like the more junior staff, didn't mean that it wasn't a nightmare for Hillary, for example. So this was not would have been not really clear to me. But like, I'm 23 or something at this point, 24. But for a couple of years, it meant that I was working on books. Other people will have different views on what happened, but Hillary was less available both to me but also to the authors because of the kind of managing Penguin and the new relationship, trying to keep quality control and a sense of set independence within the larger company and all these sort of values. So I ended up working on books that were quite, became like Cloud Street, you know, shorthand. And
let's just pause there, shall we? So you worked on Cloud Street.
It was clearly an amazing book to have worked on. And it was a book that, in a way, my relationship with that book was a bit like my relationship with books I write myself. And that was interesting to kind of realise that a book had got under my, gets under your skin, or the words get under your skin to that degree. And then I was dreaming of the characters, and all the things that happen when you're writing a book, for me, happened when I was editing that book. Now, the book was very, Tim is very good and knows what he wants.
Yeah.
With some books I worked on, like I worked, say, on Cosmo Cosmolina, Helen Garner's, one of her earlier books.
Oh, my God.
And I can remember conversations I had with her about, you need to think of doing this or that, and that was great. Tim didn't really need it. He needed production support and covers and, like, a bit of character. But, well, it wasn't like a massive editing job, but it was a big, I was still managing the whole.
Obviously, that's a sort of a quite a momentous start. Most of the editors starting out in publishing today probably don't get thrown quite in the deep end like that. Yeah. So it'd be good to hear about some of those early experiences, if you're open to talking about them, and the move to being a publisher.
The main thing I'd say actually about editing Tim Winton was he taught me quite a lot about, well, for editing and indeed my life as a writer, rhythm of language. He does write. He doesn't write poetry exactly, but he's got an incredibly strong sense of rhythm. And so that was, I think, I do have a really strong sense of realising when I was doing the copy edit of kind of just picking up on moments where the rhythm didn't quite, the internal logic that I had gathered he had for his own rhythms wasn't always quite there, or occasionally felt a bit forced. And I think the thing about editing good work is that you also learn what is possible, so you become more ambitious for other writers that you then go on to work with. I edited some short stories, and so that was a kind of it is actually a form I really like. It's almost like this continuous narrative, even though the stories or the kind of what was in that collection was not, they weren't totally joined up. It wasn't like, say, a Frank Morehouse, but even again, as a writer, I think it's form I really like as well, rather than trying to make this kind of homogenous, even coherent kind of narrative that kind of lots of different contradictions and ideas at play. My main memory of editing Helen's work, other than the force of her personality, was
I was going to say she's formidably beautiful writer, and so I've got such admiration for her. Was that intimidating? Was it sort of?
I think obviously I probably managed to do what I did because I wasn't intimidated, I suppose.
Yep.
I did, like, because I was sort of privileged accidentally in this way. I ended up working with lots of quite authors that are now very well established and famous, and even though Helen was, I suppose, well known back then, she wasn't Helen as she is now. I mean, this was all 30 years ago, so in that sense I wasn't as intimidated as I might have been. But again, with her, it wasn't the sentences. I think with Tim occasionally we'll talk about sentences. With Helen, it wasn't sentences, it was so much sort of internal logics. I actually have used this example when I've taught, you know, one of the characters in the novella, the main character in the novella, walks out into the backyard, puts out the washing, doesn't bring it in for what I realised was about 6 months. you know, so it's kind of, which is because the scenes have moved around. In fact, in general, I often found that people would move scenes around, or kind of the beats of their narrative would get kind of reformulated constantly as they drafted, and there'd be kind of vestiges of earlier drafts or earlier kind of moments or timelines would kind of slip in. And I remember doing a lot of work actually with both Tim and Helen on the cover. I mean, not just with them, with the designer, and with the first Cloud Street cover that ended up being pulled together very much at the last minute. I don't even quite remember why it was such a chaotic process, and it's a sort of a very evocative cover, but it's not a classic cover. It did not last the test of time and got recovered. Once the book took off, that got recovered. And with Helen's, it was a really beautiful cover. I don't actually have a copy of it with me, but so those kind of, I've always been very interested, you can actually see from looking at my office, in visual I'm interested in painting myself. I'm interested in art, and I do think one of my talents as a someone who worked in publishing was able, I could look at roughs and think, oh, that'll make a good cover, or that won't make a good cover. I could relate well to designers, and I had some sense of design, as indeed did Hilary and Diana, who was all, you know, sort of formative people. So I think not just being about words is important when you're an editor, but having a sense of overview, or maybe an editor who is going to become a publisher, which is what happened to me, maybe that sense of overview is one of the reasons why I made that shift. I'm not totally sure. I mean,
yeah. So can you tell us a little bit? So were you aspiring to be a publisher at that point, or was it kind of just...
No, I didn't understand. I didn't really understand what a publisher did. To be honest, I didn't understand what a publisher did when I became publisher. as I think got documented at the time, it was a traumatic period because it was actually related to the fact that I had a relationship with Tim Winton as an editor. And it meant that when Hilary left, when her contract ended 3 years after the buyout or two, when she left, if I left, and I had assumed I would go and keep working with her wherever she went, and I actually think it was public very quickly that she was going to Pan. I actually can't remember the order of events. And I think Penguin were concerned that they would lose significant authors such as Tim. And to my surprise, offered me the job of publisher to replace Hilary. It hadn't crossed my mind that would happen. I was in my late 20s. I sort of had picked up, because I'd worked closely with Hilary, what a publisher did. I also think that I'm someone who, while I think I am a good editor, I don't think I could spend my whole life focused on detail and kind of really being embedded in other people's material. I'm getting bored is not the right word. I start to want to do other things or kind of become involved. And I actually really like thinking about how a book is marketed, the covers, as we were talking about, as well as the text.
Well, and I guess, like you were saying earlier, you did have a lot of that experience of really assessing manuscripts up front. Mm-hmm. So in terms of having those instincts and also having the ability to, like, I see one of the big differences, and I'd be fascinated to get your thoughts on this, but one of the really big differences is, yeah, that attention to detail, that kind of, I quite love being immersed in the book work. That's where I kind of go into my zone and feel quite happy and pleased, and I love that kind of detailed problem solving and deep level kind of communication, which is not to say that you don't do that as a publisher, but you've also got to do a lot of, you've really got to be a lot more vocal and sort of be winning in your pitch and a lot more sort of extroverted, I think, in terms of building really sort of strong connections, identifying the manuscripts, but also kind of championing those in-house, don't you?
Yes, I think I had that kind of personality, but it was not, I didn't really particularly understand that that was what editors did, I mean publishers did versus editors. And I think the real advantage of McPhee Gribble was that everyone got to work on every aspect of a book, so I probably had the perfect training for someone who was going to become a publisher quite quickly. But that, like I said, it really only dawned on me was an issue about 4 days before it happened, when I had a conversation with Bob Sessions, where I was suddenly like, oh, I see, this might happen. And so I suppose I had like a couple of days warning that I could think about if I was just going to avoid that conversation or embrace the opportunity, knowing that it would be hurtful to Hilary.
Yes, right.
So
one of those bittersweet moments, yes. An opportunity, but also, yeah, fair enough. That's so hard.
But what I didn't quite understand, I mean, I think Hilary's frustration with it was that she had years and years of experience and I did not. And it is, she's absolutely, if she said this, I think she did say it to other people, she certainly said it to me, if I didn't have all the experience I needed, I mean, I was on, it's true, I was on an extremely steep learning curve, and while Bob Sessions was not was extremely different person to Hilary McPhee, he was very patient about talking about some of those publisher skills. We didn't really talk about editing, for example. Most of the staff resigned as soon as I was appointed, the staff that was left, because they were, but they, you know, went and worked with Hilary. So.
Yeah. And that's not unusual for big sort of turnovers, is it?
I mean, well, I now see it's not unusual. It was a bad day, though, because I just had a sort of.
Yes, I can imagine. I can imagine. Yes. Very dramatic. But you see how sweeping changes kind of go through the publishing industry and authors move and shift as well with publishers. So
I very quickly had to think, oh, I've got to build my own team. So I did that. I'd met Meredith Rose, who now I think is someone who's always been very clear. She wants to be an editor, not a publisher. She's one of Australia's best editors. And she'd finished the publishing. She'd just done the publishing editing course. I think she was in her 30s. She'd had done other things before she went to editing. And I remember meeting with her and McPhee Gribble at Mario's, McPhee Gribble, and asking her if she would, or her saying, I can't even remember if she said, I could help, we could work together, or I said, I actually can't really remember that. I also remember another meeting at Mario's with Miranda Salt, who now runs a gallery in Paris, and she ended up being my sort of assistant, kind of the office manager of McPhee Gribble, and Nikki Klempner, who was working at Penguin, who asked if she could come across and work on the McPhee Gribble book. And I can't even remember. I was certainly delighted and that she wanted to do that again. I can't remember who approached who. I do remember her asking Bob Sessions to kind of saying, so I don't want to leave Penguin, but I would like to go and work on this list. So that was kind of the team that got pulled together. And also I had to find books. And again, I didn't quite, I can't actually really understand how I managed to do it. Fiona McGregor and Christopher Cyril were the first two books I actually commissioned, fiction books that I commissioned. I certainly remember that Chris Cyril, I had friends in publishing who shall remain nameless, who when the books were rejected by the the different publishing houses they worked at, they'd say, I think we were mad to knock this back. Are you interested? So basically people were doing me favours and would send good stuff through. And, of course, the slush pile, as it was still there. And I also started drawing on I published a book on the countdown years. My contacts in journalism, I'd worked in journalism. I was very interested in music. So I also started to work with a designer called James DeVries, and he redesigned our logo and created a look. And that kind of process also helped me. That kind of, if you like, rebranding was an important emotional step, really, of saying it's not McPhee Gribble as it was. This is a new phase in McPhee Gribble's history. And that was kind of really, really useful. It was actually Diana Gribble who suggested that I do that. She said that she contacted me, and I loved her capacity to do this. She kind of said, you're in danger of just thinking being a publisher is trying to copy exactly what Hilary and I did, because you're young. I mean, I don't think she said that, but, you know, some version of that. You've really just got to kind of do your own thing. And so it kind of, the rebranding was part of that. And so I quite quickly started to commission friends. But those friends were people like Tim Conagrave, who wrote Holding the Man, and that's probably the best book I've ever published, or certainly the most successful book I've ever published. It's still in print after it's more than 25, it's probably 30 years now. He was a friend of a friend. I met him at a party, and he do you know the book Holding the Man?
I don't know it, but I'm gonna go and read it.
Okay, it's a gay classic. He was a young man who was dying of AIDS, and he'd met his boyfriend at a private boys' school in Melbourne. And John had already died, and it was a love story. And the school was accepting of the fact they were in a relationship, and he died during the production of the book. And it's become a stage show. It's become a film. And it's sold around the world.
Wow, that's huge. Did you do?
Yes, I did. I did. And then.
And did you do like developmental work on that as the publisher at the time?
I did quite a lot of. No, it was different because he was dying. And we weren't sure that he would live long enough to write the memoir, because it was a memoir. So in the end, and he was getting more and more fragile. So I think some of the robust conversations you have to have became more difficult for him. So he asked if he could work with Nick Enright, the playwright who was a friend. And so I did developmental work early on, and then Nick Enright worked closely with Tim to help him pull the manuscript together. And then the book came out around the I can't really talk about this book. I'm getting pretty emotional. He handed me the manuscript, and then I knew he died like a day later. I read the manuscript while he was in the hospice. Long story short, I ended up going to Alan and Unwin after he died. The manuscript's in production, and Meredith Rose oversaw the book through, she edited, did the line edit, but there was no author to work with. And Nick Enright died soon after as well. So,
yeah. Oh, wow. So you felt a real, apart from your own emotions working with through that, I guess a real honour, because it's a legacy piece, isn't it? So you would want to sort of really treat it very carefully and just respectfully. That's amazing.
Yes, and I also did a book called The AIDS Quilt Project, which, I cared very much about the death of people among my friends and community. And we did the AIDS Quilt Project book, which was, again, a kind of documentation of the quilts that were being made to honour either by the people who had died or by their families after they'd died. And Bruce Sims was also a very good support on the kind of books I was publishing, and very...
I've heard a lot about Bruce Sims, yeah.
Yes, there was a lot of goodwill. And then Martin Flanagan was one of my early authors, and Martin said, you should talk to my brother. And so I read Death of a River Guide, published Death of a River Guide. But again, I left before the book, I left just as the book was coming out. And again, Meredith Rose did a huge amount of work.
Yeah, right.
But
it would have been hard bringing those in and then sort of segueing across and not being able to finish that.
And with quite a few of these books, like with Richard, I didn't do the fine editing, but I certainly read the manuscript and said, hey, there's a whole section in here that feels like a different novel. You need to lose it. And so I did quite a lot of, because being editorial was my background, I did have quite a lot of input into the manuscripts, but I wasn't doing the fine detail.
So really more kind of sort of top end, top line directional notes and feedback before you would pass it on to Meredith or editorial.
Yeah. And then because of Tim, Cloud Street had become this huge thing, huge deal, and Tim had another book. And so then Penguin basically, Hillary and I were both competing to get the writers, and I was sent across to Perth to try and lure Tim to staying with Penguin and manage all that, which I think is basically the reason really that Penguin wanted to keep me, was to try and keep Tim. And he did go to Pan Macmillan, partly because I think Penguin misjudged. I mean, I remember the meetings, they were saying, we're going to make you a great literary figure. And he was like, I don't want to be a literary figure. And with Pan, he was like, I want to be Pan. I don't want to be Picador. Like, Tim had a very strong, he's a very smart guy and he had a very strong sense of what he wanted for his career and those kind of things. So he made that decision. I was totally, I mean, I was sad about it, but I totally got it. So it was partly to work with Hillary, but also because Pan Mac and Hillary, I suppose, read him better, whereas Penguin was, I don't think Penguin quite understood the emotional territory they were in. And that people felt very loyal to Hillary and all this kind of thing. Anyway, long story short, the reason why I'm going on about Cloud Street is when it really took off, they wanted to put penguins on it and take the McFigurable logo off. And it became clear to me that if I did books that were successful, they were going to get moved into Penguin, that McFigurable was going to be a ghetto kind of imprint. When I got offered the job, I said, I want us to have a separate office premises. We're happy to work with Viking O'Neill. I mean, like in I didn't mean our own little office, but not be out at Penguin Ringwood. And we all got moved to Penguin Ringwood. And then at some point I got offered a really good job with a company in Sydney, at a multinational. I did some interviews and realised that job probably, I wasn't convinced by their commitment to Australian literature, so I realised that wasn't going to work. And then I can't even remember why this happened. I think I ended up, when I was on that trip, I had lunch with Patrick Gallagher and Paul Donovan and ended up going to Allen & Unwin, even though that was not why I'd gone to in the first place.
And would you say that you were there for 10 years, so that was obviously quite a good fit for you in terms of pursuing Australian literature, pursuing the books that you were interested in?
It was, but it was, of course, inevitably, I mean, what I did have for the 2.5, 3 years I was at McFigurable was I was kind of left to it until things started going well. You could fly under the
autonomy.
Radar. Yeah. And so people were like, I think after 2 or 3 years, they're like, oh, she's doing quite a good job. Oh, maybe we should incorporate more into Penguin. But like, we were sort of left alone for a couple of years and it was incredibly exciting and a great honour and Penguin were incredibly supportive. But then there was going to be a requirement really that I become part of the bigger corporation, which I actually understand now. At the time I didn't, but like, I understand why all this was. It's not unreasonable, but I just thought, I don't want to. Partly also, I think the weight of coming from McFigurable, I didn't really want to continue to be feeling that I had to honour an independent press and receive only grief for trying to do that and not get doing it the way people thought I should. I just thought if I went to Allen & Unwin, I could kind of do my own thing. However, Allen & Unwin was a very, very much more pancake structure. I didn't have as much autonomy. There wasn't as much money for advances. So while I liked being there a lot and I've learned a lot from every publisher that I've worked with, you know, Hillary and Bob and Patrick, they're all very different. And I think the way that I distinguished myself at Allen & Unwin was not through the fiction, even though I think I had an eye for that, but I think I published some really good nonfiction. I actually think that my nonfiction, as a publisher, you probably would say that I was a better nonfiction publisher than a fiction publisher.
Do you think, though, that, so two questions here. One is, in terms of advances for publishers, how much do you think it's really hard to compete if you haven't got the same funds, right? So it's really hard to sort of, I mean, that is a big issue for authors and it means a lot to their sort of continued work and career, which I'm sure you appreciate as an author as well. Do you think that money is the sole factor, or what other things in that publishing role can?
No, I don't think it's the sole factor. I mean, you know.
So you do think the relationship and the understanding of the work?
I think it was. I don't know how much that stands now. I mean, I do think that, I mean, I both, at all the different houses, because I ended up working at Lonely Planet for a year as well. So that's, when I say all the different houses, so you know, that's kind of the entirety, I of the places I worked. But when anyone ever said to me, I'll just sign the contract, I trust you, I was always like, well, don't. I mean, like, I could get hit by a bus, I could change jobs. You need to make sure you're happy with the publisher. And certainly things happened at Allen Unwin, which I'm sure would have happened at Penguin. It's just that I was at Allen Unwin for longer. You make promises and you can't always live up to them. Mm. You say the marketing people are going to do X, the marketing people don't do X.
Mm.
Possibly for extremely valid reasons sometimes.
Mm. And that is that is the pressure, isn't it? The delivering of the entire yes. thing. It's one thing to sort of produce the book and sort of deliver on that creative
yes.
Piece and make the work. It's the whole other end of the package too.
You're only as good as your team. You can't make promises on behalf of people that they can't keep. You know, all these kind of, and I don't think, you know, when you mentioned before that the capacity to advocate for your authors. I mean, I think I managed to do that at McPhee Gribble through sheer force of will. I mean, I'm a weird mixture of an extrovert and introvert, so I think I kind of just bloom all my extroversion and it was all gone by about 35. I would be very assertive in meetings, I'd say, and people were kind of like, well, she's new, we're going to trust her. It was a harder gig at Allen & Unwin. There were more publishers, Vogels were coming through, and Patrick and Paul always like, well, we have to make sure that the sales team are behind you. And they're right, of course. Like, they're not wrong about that. But it took me a while to get that. And also when I was at McPhee Gribble, I was the new kid on the block and I was the only kid on the block. By the time I was at Allen Unwin, you know, Jane Palfreyman starting to make a real impact, Nikki Christ was making an impact, it really changed quite rapidly. I was the first, but it soon became quite a crowded room.
Yes, and I mean, it is quite a competitive, it does seem to be quite a competitive industry, which I'm sure is true for other industries like, I don't know, advertising and, you know, any kind of sort of communications industries, but publishing is a competitive space.
Yeah, and so Allen Unwin, when it was very much, I did learn, I learned that couldn't always take on books just because I love them. I had, you know, the company had to love them. And I also realised that I was publishing, just publishing from my taste wasn't always going to give me a commercial, be commercial enough. So I became better at just buying books because I thought they would do well. And I always liked everything I did, but, you know, rather than just publishing because I just felt it deep from my heart, you know, like I start crying when I talk about Tim McConnagrave. I was not crying about all the books I did at Allen Unwin. It was different, you know, you kind of, you can't just drive a publishing list and a career out of personal passion. You have to kind of start to use expertise and more kind of a mature approach. So all those things happened at Allen Unwin, and I'm very grateful to have kind of learnt those skills.
Mm.
But I also started to learn that unless I felt that real connection, I was less interested in the job, you know. But so, I mean, I said that Allen Unwin didn't have enough money. It's also that Patrick was a bit more of a kind of wasn't going to throw money at a new list in the way that people were prepared to throw money at me. And also I wasn't actually buying books that needed a lot of money because these were all new, I was publishing or debut authors. And Allen Unwin, when I was getting bigger books offered to me, and there were, Patrick absolutely did back quite a few of the books I did with proper money. But I do remember this, there was a non-fiction book going around. I won't say what it was, but I just was desperate to get it. I was hysterical. Like, I've got to get this book. And, like, the money was this kind of, all of us were hysterical. By all of us, I mean all of us and like all of us in publishing, in Sydney anyway. And I remember Patrick just, it was like he could kind of see I was like an addict. He said, no, you've got to calm down. Like, just calm down. And he was just really trying to talk me off a ledge and making me understand other books would come. This book probably wasn't going to make two. I can't even remember what it went for because I stopped bidding. but it wasn't going to make hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, that the market was being out of control. And again, incredibly useful reality checks. I've been incredibly grateful for all the people I've worked with who have given me those reality checks. But I did start to feel that as the industry was kind of, I suppose as the 90s, we're into the, well into the 90s now, the mid 90s or even the late 90s, that I started to feel that my skill really had to be winning things at auction, because by this stage there's the ascendancy of the agents. People are starting to move publishers a lot more. And so really my job became, it started to feel like this weird form of prostitution where you're all trying to win over the agents. You're all kind of like me the best. And then going to meet the authors and you're like,
yes, and further away from using your instincts to identify talent and then championing that and that kind of thing.
Yes, that's right. And with the authors, you're like me. And being good, to get back to editing, which I know is the kind of through line of this, being a good editor is sometimes about telling people when their work is not good enough and standing by that even when they don't agree with you. And it took me a long time to actually understand that, despite my experience, that now I'm, when I edited at Meanjin, shorter pieces, but when I was sort of back to doing lots of kind of detailed editing at Meanjin, when I was in my, like, you know, about 5, 6, 7 years after I'd left publishing, and I was much better at saying, no, if you're not prepared to fix that, it's not going to work. And I really wish I'd felt able to say that, but I was trying so hard to establish a list and I didn't want to upset authors, and that doesn't always do them a favour. So I did learn to say, you'd rather hear it from me than the reviewer. But it took me too long, really. I let things go through that I shouldn't have. And you want to be liked.
Well, and sometimes that's about it. It's about keeping the peace. But in terms of those skills, so you obviously do have the skills to be, and the technical skills to be an editor, even though that's not your preference, sort of like where your sort of, you know, your personal sort of, I guess your, where you find your zone, is obviously more in the creation, given that you now spend your time being an author. But in terms of editorial, what do you think are those skills? Like for me, I guess it was time. It has been experience that has really just trial and error, learning by, you know, not, you know, sometimes making a mistake, you kind of go, okay, well, I'd probably do that again differently, reflecting on your own practice and your own work. But
so that's all true. And I think the two things happen. One is that I had strong instincts. Hillary was very good at saying you have to trust your instincts and you'll find out if they're wrong. Like if your instincts are incorrect, authors will tell you, I will tell you, but you have to actually have self-confidence or you can't do the job, because your kind of sense of sureness about what you're doing is the tool you have. Your brain is the tool. So you have to kind of use that with some kind of confidence, and if you're continually getting it wrong, then you're not being very good at what you do. But then you learn all the other things we've been talking about. The importance of being able to market effectively, the fact that if there are too many similar feeling novels out there, that several of them will sink, the best one may not be the one that doesn't sink, that authors' personalities do have some bearing on these things, and that the book has to be really tight. Now, I don't know that I feel... I know that you want to ask me about what's happening today. I feel that there is not enough editing of books. I mean, I used to get very irritated when people said that 20 years ago, but now I'm sort of saying it too. And while I stopped being a copy editor quite early in my career, I would do a lot of editing up front, as in big picture editing. And we had in-house editors at Penguin, and Penguin was always really good on the editorial. I had really strong editorial skills, really good editors there, and they always really valued it. I don't know what it's like now, but back then they did have that. Alan and Unwin was already using the model that is very common today of, you know, getting freelancers. And I don't know how much the budgets have gone up, but I think the problem is that while they were probably being paid quite reasonably for their skills, when I was there in the 90s. And also, I was also editing. Like, so they did have two people these days. I get the impression people like, you've got 5 days, fix it up, then we go into production. And, you know, I have been in the situation of when I wanted to ask some questions of my copy editor, you know, saying we'll have to see if she has the time, and then me realising that she was not going to be paid for her time to have a conversation with me about the, you know, and so this kind of, it's just, it's...
So it's actually curtailing that kind of model, in a sense, curtails your ability to, A, spend a bit of time on a manuscript, which, do you think, of all the, like, time does seem to be probably the biggest thing that's changed. So the technology itself kind of changed. So
And time is what you need as a writer.
Mm.
Like, sometimes, I mean, I don't know, if someone says this aspect of my novels is no good. It's never hard to fix a problem, but it can be hard to know how to fix it. And time is what takes that. Mm. And I also, and this and also happens with publishers, and I could be, probably people would say I might be one of the publishers responsible. I do think publishers were taking books on before too early, and authors are offering them too early. And I mean, certainly I didn't always identify that a person couldn't do, you know, a person is trying to redraft and get it better, but under the constraints of a contract. I think books are contracted before they're ready.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting because it's like
one including of the dilemmas. Including some of mine, I'm sure. I mean, I'm not trying to.
Yeah, yeah. Look, point. I think it's across the industry wide. I don't think it's sort of specific, and there is such competition out there now to secure authors and get the work kind of contracted early, but then probably not enough time in that development, because it's interesting that, you know, as an author, of course, it takes time to write and respond to. It's that response, isn't it? It's like, well, what is the, what, you know, you've got one chance to kind of fix an issue or make changes. And it's like, well, what is the best fix? You know, you sort of have to have a go to realise. And I feel like that's the same with editorial. Like, it just takes time, because before I can sort of really suggest a change, you've almost got to try it to see if it'll work. Otherwise, why would you? Do you know what I mean? So you can back in what you're doing. So you're doing a lot of that work before you.
And so this is where the marketing, the fact that the marketing stuff and having reading copies, all that's got much stricter since, I mean, there's much more kind of process than when I started. So there's just no elastic in there anymore in the time frame.
So I mean, that's definitely on the editorial side. I mean, I think every editor who will listen to these interviews will go, oh gosh, if we could only have more time. And I do think a lot of publishers also say, yes, we need to really sort of reflect on that. But it doesn't sort of seem to action any changes. Because this is just so fascinating, can you talk to me a little bit about why you then sort of ended up sort of exiting, I suppose, from that publishing role? Yeah. I mean, the Meanjin role would have been highly editorial, highly respected editorial role, and still is today. And a real, you know, it's a very well-respected journal. So you've obviously sort of stepped. At what point did you know, gosh, you know, I don't want to be in this role anymore. I really want to have a crack at writing. And how was that complete?
I just started to feel really jealous. You know, authors would ring me and say, oh, I've got the Paris Junior, I've got this, I've got that. And I just started to feel really jealous. And I thought, that's not cool. That kind of sense of being in competition with your authors. And also I did find that the bleeding between my personal and professional life, the fact that, you know, every week, I'm exaggerating now, I do like an exaggeration, but it's probably true today, even if it wasn't true back then.
Well, you are an author.
Most weekends you have events, evenings you have events. You become friends with these people who are also going to get pissed off at you inevitably, either rightly or wrongly, depending on the interests. It's just relentless and tiring. It involves too much alcohol. I couldn't keep up with the drinking. I'm not actually being facetious about that. I just was exhausted by it. And I really did that kind of that sense about it being a popularity contest. Also my realisation that the books I loved the most weren't necessarily the ones that were going to do the best, which is fine. But then I kind of, you know, would start to do books that I think I should that I thought this book will do well, this is a fine book, and they would do better. And I just started to think, the sense of my, I suppose this is a kind of narcissistic position, the sense of the list somehow being an extension of my sensibility no longer held ground in the same way. So for all these reasons, I started to think I needed to move back to Melbourne for personal reasons. So for all these reasons, I went down to part-time. I also took, this is skipping back, I did too many books. I wasn't really, and Patrick did try, I mean, he tried many times to explain this to me and I kept not listening. But I kept taking on, ending up doing 20 or 25 books in a year, trying to edit them rather than trying to do six big books in the way, so that Julie Gibbs did when she was at Penguin. In fact, she and I switched, basically. She was our one when I was at Penguin, we switched. Very different lists and very different approaches, but she was very much, you know, a kind of publisher as a curator and a very kind of strong design sensibility. And maybe, I don't know how many books she did in a year. If you interview her, you can ask her. But, you know, different approach, whereas I was just like taking on heaps of novels, heaps of nonfiction, and doing books, trying to be a generalist, which was what Alan Unwin needed from me. And I'm not a good generalist. I'm good at doing what I'm passionate about. You know, so all these things, I started to think, I think I'm in the wrong. And also, I've always thrived better in smaller environments. And Alan Unwin's a big company, even if it's an independent. And I'd love that it wasn't independent. But, you know, I loved McFeagrible because it was small. It was one of the reasons I went to Text and then to Ultimo. I like working with small publishers. I liked being at a small publisher. It's why I wanted to be on the, you know, on the board of the UQP, because I really, I find that kind of suits me better every which way, either as someone who's working there or, and a discomfort with the kind of corporatisation of publishing in general. I mean, I understand that they have to make money. I realise I sound very naive and unrealistic, but it's not, you end up not being, it ends up being a different industry. So one of the things that happened when I was at Alan and Unwin was the Harry Potter. So.
Oh, yeah, of course. Well, that changed the landscape somewhat, didn't it?
It changed the landscape. So, you know, and I'm sure my memory is probably, there is some delusion in this, but I seem to remember pitching novels and saying, oh, look, I think it'll do 3,000. I think it's pretty good. I think this person's an important writer and we can build them. Those conversations become harder to have 10 years down the track when some of your books haven't done so well and Harry Potter is doing 100, 200, 300,000. Is there enough paper in the country to produce enough Harry Potters at any given time? You know, so it really has changed a lot. I mean, Patrick is no longer running it day to day in the way that he did when I was there. Harry Potter has happened, you know, so I sort of, around that time, it was partly just for personal reasons. I think I thought, I really do want to be a writer. I was about to turn 40. I want to be a writer. I've got to take a chance sometime. So I went to part-time and just continued to work on the books that I had in train and then at some point I stepped back altogether. But I was doing the part-time gig for an extra, another couple of years in Melbourne. And I was no longer part of the company in the same way. I mean, like once I moved to Melbourne, I was not like a real player anymore, but I was continuing to work with Alan Unwin. Now, Patrick's version of this, which could well be right, was that I said, I'm just going to Melbourne for a few months, but I'll be back full time. So I think he feels that I just sort of snuck out backwards.
Ah. And yeah, you felt it was more of a deliberate staged, yeah. Well, yes, it sounds like
I have no idea how well I communicated with him. It was a difficult. I mean, I ended up having endometriosis and having to have surgery and having to take a lot of time off work. And Alan and I were amazing. They've always been really exceptional at those kind of supporting their staff, and they're very loyal.
Yeah.
To their staff.
Well, I mean, people who go to Alan and Unwin never seem to leave. So. Yeah,
it's because it's a good workplace, yes. You know, which is in a way separate to why you're in publishing. And I think my reasons for leaving were to do with frustrations with publishing, not with Alan and Unwin, if you know, I have nothing but, admiration. I continue to have nothing but admiration for the work they do.
Oh, they're so successful. And I was just going to say, you probably felt like your books weren't selling and that they weren't as successful. But, I mean, that history, that piece, continuing that history has been a real, cornerstone of the industry in terms of what they publish and what they provide. And they're so very well known.
And Gangland, I did some really good books there. I didn't mean to suggest, but I also did books because I felt that I had to produce a certain number of books. Whereas I think at McPhee Gribble, at McPhee Gribble Penguin for my time there, I have a list somewhere. I think almost every book I could stand by. I just had a real,
really proud of, and yeah. And I do wonder whether that's just a natural result of working for such a long time in the industry too. You do realise that after a while, there are a number of books and it's hard to be proud of all of them in the same way. A lot of younger editors today, or people, emerging editors, are also emerging writers. They want to work in publishing. I never quite know what to tell them, but you've got experience in both. But I was just
I do tell people that they want to be writers that they shouldn't be working in publishing.
Would be really hard.
They should go and make some money.
Yes.
I was on a writer's retreat a few years ago now with someone who made a living as a roof painter, a roofer or a house painter. Anyway, the point is that he worked really hard 6 months a year. He was in work. It was a very physical labour, and the 6 months a year he focused on his own projects and he made money. I'm now about to turn 60. I don't have enough super. I do 4 or 5 jobs at any given time, and I'm lucky. I earn less than the average. I earn almost no money. If I didn't have a partner, I could not even do any of the things I do. A partner who had a stable income. This kind of feeds back, I think, to the issue about editing and moving too fast. I think that comes from writers as well as publishers. I think we and I've done this absolutely, you're kind of so desperate to get your book out there because you want to make an income and you want a career as a writer. This is not going to happen. I mean, it's going to happen for Trent Dalton or Tim Winton. It's not going to happen for like 90% of people. So there's no point in rushing a book out. So I continue to write because it means a lot to me, but it's financially it was a rash move, and it's why I went back to Meanjin. I actually loved being at Meanjin, but it's why I did go to Meanjin, because I suddenly thought, oh God, I have to have more income, and Meanjin was theoretically a part-time job. I have no regrets about doing that, but I think on a personal level, I think I was scared of becoming a management person. When in fact, I now look back and think, if I had managed to make my way up through the ranks at Alan Unwin or Penguin, that could have been really interesting. And I could have done some really interesting work as a more managerial person. But I had that kind of youthful contempt for people who were doing that rather than the hands-on stuff. And I do regret that. I don't regret my life, but I do think I could have maybe done some really interesting stuff. I really admire people who stay in the same job at the same company for a long time, because I think that they can really make a difference in a way that I didn't quite. I was too impatient to kind of mature my career within publishing. However, I did genuinely want to write, and I, wrote Geography, my first novel, relatively quickly once I went part-time. And then I auctioned it, and it was probably the most auctionable of my books. And I ended up, I got a more substantial offer from Penguin, but partly because of history and partly because that was a two-book contract and I had reservations about a two-book contract. I went to Text. Text have been a great publisher for me. But Mandy was a very good editor is a very good editor, very hands-on. So my work was not freelanced out for the copy editing. You know, I was really privileged that for quite a few of my books, I had someone working with that level of care on them. But I've also done books that have been probably more commercially successful, not the geography, but with other publishers, where it's been a different kind of working model. Say Melbourne, which was a great publishing idea. Working with Philippa McGuinness taught me a lot about publishing, because she had a real sense of that. I'm doing a series, I'm doing it this way. She had a kind of vision and a view for the long term. She was really good at picking authors that were a bit quirky and not the obvious author. You'd say that about every one in the series. They're all really good books. I'm pretty sure it's probably the best-selling of my books for adults. But you did have the freelance thing of kind of, you know, the person not having enough time to work on the book and all that kind of stuff. All the other publishers I've worked with other than text, that's been an issue.
Okay, that's really interesting to hear. So from an author's point of view, you actually think it is better working with an in-house editor. You do get more sort of, yeah. Well, you get more time. You get more priority,
definitely.
I suppose.
No, I definitely think it's better.
Mm.
Which isn't to say that, I mean, I have, with everything I've worked on, a good proofreader who tends to be a freelancer can often make amazing observations or make you suddenly think, oh, Jesus, I didn't realise that, or they're right. Or like, so I'm not saying that you don't want, that there's not a lot that people who just dip in and out of a project can really make a profound difference to a project. But yeah, I do.
I guess it's that there's a finite amount of time, whereas if someone's working on it in-house all the time, they're there to have those conversations and to follow up and to say, yeah, I'm going to be with you the whole way, keep tinkering.
But it's very hard for someone to be both a really fantastic publisher and a really good hands-on editor, or have the time to be both things. And Mandy is a senior editor. She has a publisher's sensibility, but what she is, she does a huge amount of text work on the text. I mean, I don't have any criticisms of anyone I've worked with. I mean, it's more that you just see different how different companies are trying different models. And outsourcing all your editing, I don't think, is best for the books. It might be better for the company's bottom line. It's also not so good for training. Like, I mean, I've talked about the kind of training I had, and you know, I had a lot of people very patient with me. I was probably very arrogant and annoying and didn't know what I didn't know. That was fine. It's much harder for people to just pick that up in an ambient way when they've basically done a course and then they're getting sent manuscripts and they're like, I don't have anyone to ask, I'm not sure, oh, I don't like this manuscript, I don't know, how do you edit a book you don't like? All these things, which the conversations are quite complex.
Yes, that collegiate relationship in-house really helps with that. And I noticed that some editors are being sent manuscripts, working on them, and then once the author responds, they don't actually even see it again. And I'm like, I just think personally as an editor, I just think it's not complete until you've had that opportunity to kind of say, great, you know, great, or oh, what about this now, or you know, it really does take time and there's no cutting corners. And I think maybe that's one of the things out of this entire discussion that needs to be I guess reiterated from the entire industry in some ways. Okay, I've taken up heaps of your time. Just quickly, how do you see the future of this industry? How do you sort of see it playing out?
I kind of don't know, to be honest. I mean, I did think about this, but I mean, I've spent my whole working life since the late 1880s with people making pronouncements. Sometimes I was making them, sometimes other people were making them. And I'm a bit sick of pronouncements on the future of the industry. I mean, you know, I feel a bit negative at the moment, but I think that's almost irrelevant. Because inevitably you feel grumpy after 40 years in an industry, you know, you wouldn't be human not to. So I sometimes think, I mean, I do think that more money needs to be spent on editorial again as well as marketing, that there has been a swing, and I am concerned about that. that I do think that there are implications for publishing, that every book has to make back its money. I understand why this is, and I have been privy or seen situations where publishers, for various reasons, that's not done, and that it can have dire consequences. So again, I don't want to sound naive, but there is such a thing as building a writer, but that doesn't really happen anymore. And this was happening back in the 90s, so that's why I feel like I'm talking. This was a criticism in the 90s. There was a lot of money being thrown around. People would have big first books. I think, and I could be getting the details wrong, The River Ophelia is an example. Maybe it wasn't Justine Atwood's first book, but the second book didn't do nearly as well. And then my understanding is that she might have dropped the publisher, or the publisher dropped her. I don't want to misspeak, but it's an example of a lot of excitement about debut authors, and then again, it's all over, that kind of sense about, and like Tim had had 5 or 6 books before Cloud Street. I mean, that is not unusual.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a slow burn career, isn't it? It is not, yes. Every book cannot necessarily be a success or a success in the same way. Yeah.
And I do think there's too much focus on debut, and it can be really, which is partly, I understand, responding to the, there's no point in publishing books if no one's going to read them. But I do think that it can be much harder for people to have a long-term career and continue to get readers. I also think too many books are being published. I just flat out do. I am very active in the industry. I cannot keep up with reading all the books that are coming out at any given time. And I know that when...
Especially if the quality is compromised.
Yeah, and even if it's not, compromised, I think that it's... because there's a run of books at the moment where the quality is not... You know, I've got my by my bed, you know. Chris Tropas, Melissa Lukashenko, Richard Flanagan, Charlotte Wood, Catherine Lumbion, Frank Morehouse. I've got another, there's a lot of books that I really want to read at the moment and I can't keep up. So I do think the industry does, and there needs to be, I don't really know where, that's why I don't like making pronouncements, because I don't know what I'm, they got, where do I go with that, you know?
Yeah. And maybe that is, maybe that is partly this fatigue. I do wonder. It's like there's a lot of energy and a lot of positivity coming through, through in younger generations, and there's still this real desire for people to want to write and want to express themselves and want to work on books. And it's almost like maybe that's part of the answer, is sort of letting that come in. But it has to then be, people taking on that mentoring role and that chaperoning and that teaching and training. And
also understanding that you might be doing books that only publish, only sell 1,000 copies, but you know why you're doing it, rather than that sense about throwing mud at a wall and, sorry to call writers mud, but I'm mud too, and just seeing what sticks, I do think that there needs to be kind of a, but there are a lot of very good people in the industry, and there always have been. And like I said, when you've been working with people saying the industry is about to die for it's pretty well since I started, I don't take it seriously. I mean, it's kind of like maybe it won't. And there are a lot of very good small presses around, even if they're owned by larger companies, but they're being allowed to, Ultimo Press is allowed to express its own self, even if it's part of Hardy Grant. All these things. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. Well, I'd just like to say we've probably got to wrap up. I know you've got to get on with your day and continue writing, but I would just really like to say one of the things that's really shone through for me today is that you have had the courage and the commitment to just continue to do things that you get a lot of intrinsic value from. So, you're obviously very talented in the sense that you've been able to move with your instincts and then move in through all of these roles, have had an incredible career. It's the stuff of publishing legends, Sophie, and still, be able to kind of say, no, I want to write. That's where my pleasure is now, and that's what you're doing. And you, 9 books later, you're on the 9th or 10th now?
9th. I'm working on the 10th.
Working on the 10th. There we go. So we look forward to seeing that coming out. And thank you very, very much for your time.
That was Sophie Cunningham in conversation with Jacqueline Blanchard as part of Beyond the Margins, Australian Editors in Conversation. Edited transcripts of each interview are available on the iPED website, iped-editors.org. Thank you for listening.